Ian Oland, on Wednesday night, you had a big night out of the town. Would you tell me about it?
Yes, it was a rare night out of mom's basement for me. I was invited by Craig Laughlin to be a guest at the Laughlin Family Foundation dinner and party. There was a silent auction, and there were a bunch of fun local sports celebrities there. And I got to meet a ton of people that I have never talked to before, and I was freaking out the whole time inside my head. For instance, I got to have like a 20-30 minute conversation with Haley Skorupa about everything women's hockey related, and I got to ask every question that I ever had about women's hockey, which is a lot. Like, I didn't really understand the complexities of what's kind of the battle between the NWHL and the touring women, the all-stars that are playing around, and what her vision thinks, what her vision of women's hockey should be. She really deeply believes in kind of like a WNBA system, but for where they work with the NHL. And so that was just really fascinating. I think, you know, there was other things that happened later in the night, and I'll get to that. But I think the best part of the night was just having a heart-to-heart conversation with head coach Todd Reirden. Of all the people that I thought I'd be talking to for a long time that night, I didn't think it'd be Todd. A long time ago, when I would first meet athletes and people like that, I would be really timid. My mom is a naturally shy woman, and, you know, everyone in the family kind of sticks to themselves. And it isn't, you know, like my brother was a reporter, but it's always a little awkward to talk to people. And but I've learned to put myself out there. And especially if I'm going to write about Todd Reirden all the time, I should say, hey, I'm Ian. I'm the guy that writes about you all the time. And give them the opportunity to be able to say, hey, I love you. Or, hey, man, I really want to punch you in the face. And when I talked to Todd, he was a huge fan of the site. I promise that everything that we said was pretty much off the record. But it was a really, really interesting conversation. And I found it funny that you know, from the outside, when you look at some of these athletes and you go, well, my personality matches with Kuzi, or my personality matches with Verana, because like I'm more of a silly guy. But then when you meet these people in real life, Verana was one of the players there. He kind of like hid in the corner and like didn't talk to anybody. Mm-hmm. And he is really shy. Like he is really to himself. He's a really focused guy now. And I feel like I most relate to Alex Ovechkin and Todd Reirden, like after all the people that I've talked to. Like, I think you're I think you're a little Nicky Backstrom, Peter.
Okay, so Nicky Backstrom's like borderline sociopath. So I'm insulted by that. But you did tell Coach Reirden that we are on the Todd squad, right?
Yeah, I did. I told him that. I mean, I think I can broadly speak about some of the things that he's talked about in the past.
Careful.
Yeah, I'm going to be really careful. The only thing that I feel like I can broadly dance around, because he talked about this his first year, was just like learning how to be a head coach was, you know, there's lots of things about being a head coach. You know, you're really the leader in a sense of the player part and of the coaches. And, you know, you have to be deferential on top of things. And I think, you know, I have so much respect for him from, and I told him this, is I had so much respect for him for the way he does lines, the way the team plays, looking at how good Ovi is and how much he's continued to evolve as a leader. And I just want fans to know that just like, you know, this is the first time I got to talk to him. I haven't talked to many Capitals head coaches. This is the first one that's like opened up to me and talked to me. And he's a really good guy. And he's really nice, really fun, really, really smart, really, really smart. And I think the Caps have a great guy behind the bench. And it was cool to really talk to him. And I really appreciate his, I really appreciate him being a fan of the site. I mean, just saying that he reads the site, you know, it's just crazy. To me, right? That's crazy.
Yeah,
to you,
I mean, right? It's good, but then I'm thinking like, oh, great, because at least put some crazy stuff up there sometimes. I'm like, oh gosh, you saw? Oh, well, whatever. The thing that like, I don't know. So like, I'm a Todd fan too, right? And I keep thinking like, Barry Trotz, like, yeah, he had some coaching problems, but he was a really, you know, stand up guy. I don't think anyone ever.
Yeah,
you know, put a thing to him, you know, personally. He just made some decisions that, you know, irritated. I guess all coaches do after a certain amount of time. But like I think a lot of people like Barry because he had a lot of like sort of personality stuff that either made it into like broadcasts or like the Capitals release a video about like, I guess it was like Big Brothers, Big Sisters. Is that what he was doing stuff with?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And like, I just, you know, I'm not here to tell, you know, the Caps digital media production group to what to do, but man, they could certainly give Todd some good FaceTime. It's time for Todd's close up, you know?
Yeah.
Like, let the fans know this fella.
He's really, the thing about Todd is that like, so this is something I can speak to is that when he does press conferences, he's really honest. And I think he's as honest as he can go all the time. Kind of like, I think him and Brian McClellan have the same vibe now when they do interviews. And I really respect it because I don't think a lot of coaches go too far. I think he's so careful sometimes with the way that he speaks during press conferences that he's not as articulate maybe as he can be. And then I feel like there's that disconnect where people don't really get his personality much. Like the Capitals posted a video of him at, the women's night out, at Kettler. I forget what it's called. Hockey and Heels. And he was the guy I met on Wednesday in this video where he's just like, I'm just here having a great time. And he's talking about women's hockey and how important it is. And, you know, he has a ton of personality in a good way. And I agree with you is that like, he's a guy that I think they really should focus on more. I know they did videos of him in development camp like 2 years ago coming into his first year as head coach. And that stuff was really well done too. I mean, I kind of wanted to run through a wall after I talked to him too. I mean, the guy is just he's very confident and he's very smart and he's both of those things because, you know, he looks in the analytics. He is a guy who's played hockey all his life. He was a former NHL player. He's positive. A bunch of respect towards guys. He really wants to make guys better. I can see why they wanted to hire him. I mean, just after talking to him one time, I mean, I've never gotten that vibe from another coach. So he's a really cool dude, and I think they're lucky to have him. I kind of want to throw the conversation really quick to one other thing or a few other things. I met a few other people at the dinner. One of them was Brooks Robinson. A lot of you probably saw the story that I wrote on Thursday. And it was the only story I wrote on Thursday. I apologize for that. It was
a wonderful story.
So my mom, when she was 12 years old in 1964, she was going to Brunswick Middle School in Frederick, Maryland. My dad was he was a caboose driver and a person that basically collected the tickets, a conductor. He worked for the B&O Railroad, and so they kind of were poor. They lived along the Potomac River. And there was a free Orioles game that they got to go to. So mom and her best friend took a bus. Her parents signed off of it to Memorial Stadium to see the Orioles play. I think it was the Cleveland Indians that day. So all these kids, there's 20,000 kids at the stadium. There's so many kids in the lower bowl that they open up the upper deck, which they weren't thinking that they were going to do. So as all these kids were going up the escalator in 1964, there was a person funneler, like a metal like guardrail that basically made people come out one person at a time. That railing or that gate was up because the night before they wanted people to go down the escalator one at a time to make it more safe. But coming up, it's the exact opposite of safe. So all these kids started flying backwards into each other. And my mom really cut her ankle bad in multiple places and was bleeding everywhere. And then her friend broke her leg in multiple places. There was a kid who died. All in all, there was 46 kids that were injured, 47 including the one who died. And so my mom, shy as she can be, after that, she was bleeding from the foot. She didn't say anything when people were looking over her. She was scared to tell. She was scared that her dad wouldn't be able to get her because, you know, the family's poor and, you know, her dad was a little bit of had a temper. And so like, she was just worried that, you know, if he found out about this, he'd blame her for that. You know, that's just a woman's mentality in the 60s. And so she grinned and bared it on the bus ride home. This is my mom, tough as can be. She goes home. So a few days later, the Orioles find out who all the kids were that got injured. They send all these kids signed baseballs, and then they could go to an Orioles game of their choosing. So my mom and my dad went to a Yankees game, and that day they go to their seats, and in the second inning, Brooks Robinson, the Orioles Hall of Fame third baseman, hit a humongous home run. He became my mom's favorite player in this moment. She loved him. And after the game, she had an opportunity to meet the players. And my mom, again, so shy, she was like, I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. So anyways, this was something that she kind of regretted all her life, 50 years later. And so Brooks Robinson was at this Craig Laughlin Foundation dinner. And so I went up to him and I was like, hey, Brooks, can I tell you a story? And I expect him to be like, oh, no, I don't got time for that. And he goes, no, I would love to hear it. Can you please tell me? And I'm like, oh, my God. And so I told him this story for about 2 or 3 minutes. And he was just like, oh my gosh. And he was like, can I record a video for your mom? And so he records the video for my mom and says, hey, Jenny, I'm sorry that I missed you, but I hope our paths cross soon. So yesterday I showed that to my mom and she was just bawling. And, you know, for all the things that my mother has done for me in my life to make me so successful and to, you know, just, you know, like she's so shy, but yet I have the personality where I can go out there and she gave me so much confidence and support all my life. She's helped raise my son. You know, it was really cool to actually do something that sweet for her. I love her so much. And, you know, I remember like she also has a rare blood clotting disease and she lost about 80% of her colon when I was a senior in high school. And I just remember her fighting through that and her being so determined to be able to walk and get to my graduation from high school. And, you know, she's just always been my hero. So that was so
great. It was a great story. And Brooks is such a cool dude.
He's an unbelievable guy.
Every couple times a year at games. And yeah, I love him. He's before my time. Like he wasn't obviously before my time, but he wasn't like a guy I grew up as like a fan of. But he was like, you know, like a mythical figure of my youth, of like Orioles of yore.
Have you noticed that like when there are like Hall of Famers and guys that we have never seen play, they just feel different?
Yeah.
Like like when I go up to him, I'm like, oh, my God, it's Brooks Robinson. You know, when I see Peter Bondra, it's a different type of feeling. And that's another guy that I met that night. I hung out with Peter Bondra for like 10 minutes and that was unbelievable. We were just talking about the old days of the Caps, of my favorite teams growing up. And then he was just talking about Ovi and he was like, it was just funny. You know, Banzai is a 500 goal scorer. And he's like, you know, I just was never as good as Ovi, you know, Ovi's so much better than me. And just to hear him say that to me, you know, I've watched both of them. I think Banzai was pretty close. You know what I mean? But the one thing that he remarked to me was that, Ovi is so close to, he's better than Brett Hall, but he thought that the way he scores goals was so similar to Brett Hall that Brett Hall had this unstoppable one-timer and he could score at pretty much any place. And he compared the two and he saw both of them as kind of like, kind of the same breath of player, but he really believes in Ovi and he's so happy to still be in this area. He still lives in Annapolis, near the, Capitals former training rink at Piney Orchard. Other people I met, Fred Smoot, he invited me on his radio show. He's a former Redskins cornerback. He is incredibly smart and funny. I talked to him for like 10 minutes. I was laughing my tush off. I hung out with Phil Schneer for like 5 to 10 minutes. And then towards the end of the night, I started hanging out with Joe B. Locker and Alan May.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Alan May started trying to claw my eyes out. He took my phone and started taking selfies of himself all across the room.
Those are technically, you own those, so you can do whatever you want with those photos.
Okay. I should put those on the internet immediately.
He sacrificed all rights and ownership. You can do whatever you want.
who else did I talk to? But yeah, it was just so, you know, I think the one thing that I want to take from this is that, so they raised $150,000 in this single dinner through like auction, silent auction items and stuff like that. And normal auction items. At the end of the night, they auctioned off an experience to meet Alex Ovechkin. Apparently he would cite anything someone brought, like, you know, and he would meet someone after the game. And that got into a bidding war up to like, I think like $10,000. Awesome. There was another opportunity where a local a Jeep company would allow someone to try and win like a $70,000 Jeep if you got the puck to go through a hole from like center ice, like you shoot at it at like a covered net. You know what I mean?
Oh my God.
So there's just some of the stuff they were selling, and Joe B was like auctioning things off for like 2 hours, and I was like getting excited just hearing Joe B auction things. It's like, wow, he can do this well too.
Hell yeah.
I hung out with Smoking Al Koken. I just like some of the pictures I took, like I put them on my personal Instagram on ENRMNB on Instagram, and it's just wild that they're contemporaries and they love me and they read the site and we're friends, and except for Alan. And, you know, it's just really great. And I, you know, I'm just so, you know, when Courtney Laughlin was talking to me at the end of the night, she was asking me, you know, what would you have fixed? There's a few things I would have changed. And I was like, Courtney, I've done 10 parties with Peter, and they're wild parties. They're fun parties. And this is probably the most fun I've ever had at a party. And I mean, where else can you go to meet all these people who are all fun and will hang out with you and just tell you stories? So like, if anyone ever has the opportunity to do any of these events with Locker and his foundation, I cannot stress enough, do it, because it not only is it for a great cause, which Peter, you may be able to speak to with rare cancers, but it is just the people that come to these things love Locker so much, and they're just good people. And I thought it was great that Verana drove up to come to it too. You know, he's a huge star in the NHL. And
where was the event?
The event was it's in Crofton, but I would say Bowie. It was really close to the Bowie ice rink. And it was right off, like, I believe, Route 3, I think. So for me, it was about a 70, 80-minute drive from Frederick, another 3-5 CD classic drive. But it was worth it. I had an unbelievable time. So
right.
That's all I can say about it. Just I could go on and on for an hour.
No, but it's great. It's great. Yeah, so like the Laughlin Foundation, yeah, is like a fundraising tool for rare cancers. I think they focus on like gynecologic cancers that, you know, like affect people with uteruses and stuff like that. So like it's a really, really fraught part of healthcare. Like rare cancers, it's like the long tail of disease where, you know, a whole bunch of people have, you know, heart problems or you know, a standard set of cancers, lots of people, like, you know, melanomas and other skin cancers. Those are really common, lung cancer, stuff like that. But then you have these like really rare diseases where there just aren't that many people. And so it's really tough to raise money to do research on them if you don't have, you know, like a dense population base of patients with a condition in an area. It's really hard to, like, if you're like a biopharmacological company, it's really hard to pay, you know, some clinic somewhere to recruit patients and have them, you know, try out a new drug. So getting money to sort of underwrite that research is necessary the way our healthcare research is laid out these days. And it's a really important process. It's like one of these things where it's a whole lot of small diseases that add up really quick. And so you find that like there's tons and tons of people that have a constellation of diseases that are in isolation rare, but in taken as a group represent a big portion of problems in American healthcare. So I'm really glad that they're doing it. It's something that matters a lot to me in my professional life as well. And I'm really happy that, you know, the Laughlins are on it.
Yeah. And his wife is just, this first time I met his wife, and she was amazing. I do want to say, by the way, that, you know, I don't want to sound really stupid, but I was probably the most starstruck by meeting Pat Sajak's son. The funniest thing was, and he, I asked him about, I was like, how many times does your dad get the Val joke? And he was like, I swear to God, everybody thinks they are so clever when they say that to him. But he was like, my dad is such a great sport about it. His son is at the University of Baltimore, and he's training to be a doctor. So go figure.
He's also a Pat Sajak, right? Like his name's also yes. Pat.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe he I don't know what he goes by.
He has just a splitting image of his dad, and he is an incredible guy. And you know, it's just like I said, like just ran into Brian Mitchell, said hi to him. Like it's just the
image.
You just turn around and you're just saying hi to someone that you've watched on TV that you love, and all of these people always, you know, other than like, you know, I tried to talk to Rod Langway and he just didn't want to talk to me.
That's fine.
Probably for the best.
It was the cigars and whiskey thing. I don't know if it was like 2018 or a year before that, but I peed next to Mel Engelstad. So there's that.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
The most famous person in NHL history to wear number 69.
Yeah.
Which is a great seg into the fact that we have a picture on our computer of a lady holding a number 69 sign from a past Caps Casino night. And she found the number 69 sign at the Lachlan Family Foundation bidding. And at the end of the night, she gave it to me as a gift. And I got Alan May to sign it for me since he has scored 69 career points for the Washington Capitals.
And didn't Locker sign it too?
Yeah. Locker signed it F-R-O, Ian, Craig Lachlan. And Peter, am I allowed to say what F-R-O means?
No, you're not. But it's not a nice thing to say to a person. And on that, and maybe on that note, we will we'll just stop right off there, and maybe we'll talk about the Washington Capitals. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. Let's do it. Yeah.
And now it's time for the RMNB podcast.
All right, it is February 7th, and the Washington Capitals have 36 wins, 13 losses, and 5 overtime losses, meaning they're the best team in the NHL at the moment. I think things are getting a little tighter than they were before. Pittsburgh looks good for some weird reason. So I think things are going excellently. Ian, do you have how would you rate the Capitals at this point?
9.5 out of 10. Is that a good rating? I don't know.
As soon as you like go like a level below that, like you're forced to talk about Alex Ovechkin, which we will in a second. But like, and obviously that's about as good as it's ever been. But the team as a whole, I mean, obviously they've got one big problem, which we'll get at. It's a weird one. It's a new problem for the team. It's the power play. But overall, I don't think that anyone can really poke a hole in the team. I mean, they're decent during even strength, right? They're out shooting their competition. They're out chancing their competition. You can see like uneven efforts. You can see too many breakaway chances, but the bottom line is like on balance, they're much stronger than their opponents have been. They're absolutely scoring, right? They've got Jacob Vrana on a path to maybe about 40 goals. Alex Ovechkin could score 7,000 this season to see how he keeps going. And they've got the best fourth line in the league. They've got John Carlson in the Norris conversation. There's a lot of really, really good stuff there. And like to that point, like I think all we can really do is be like, all right, don't screw this up and stay healthy and get into April. I guess that like invites the question about the trade deadline, which is a whole other matter. But like I feel really good about the team right now.
Yeah, I think we talked about it last night that if we're going to focus on the things that we see as wrong, or maybe it's maybe just not working maybe as good as it could. I do want to say just flat out that I think this is the best the team has ever played over the last decade. I think this is the best. I don't know how many standing points they'll have, but I think this is the best the team has played. And, you know, lately there's been a few uneven efforts, I think just because they've been struggling so much on special teams, giving up shorties, the power play in general, which we'll get to. But when we talked last night, I think I kind of pointed at third line right wing and Richard Ponick as he's a guy that at times looks really good, but I haven't really seen a great effort I don't know if effort's the right word, but I haven't seen a ton of production out of that spot, and I'm not sure that his style matches the Caps style per se. And so it's a little awkward seeing him play on that third line. So if we go to the trade deadline, I personally would maybe love to see a depth forward that could maybe slide into the third line area, because, you know, depth forwards are pretty cheap at the trade deadline. You know, they're kind of, and if you find that right guy to fit in, it can really make the team much better, like we saw with Carroll Hagelin. You know, Hagelin didn't necessarily take the Capitals deep last year, but I thought he was a huge addition. Huge addition. Then we look at defense. You know, we've talked about Nick Jensen. I think they have the guy that should, I think they have two guys that could fit into the top six at any moment, which would be Christian Jews and Martin Ferravari. And so I don't think the Caps need anything except for maybe a depth forward. And I know a lot of people haven't talked about that, but I would maybe like a guy that's better in the corners and has a little bit more solid production, or would fit in with this team better than Potek. But that's all I see. I am incredibly enthused about the playoffs. We all know it's completely random, so who knows what we'll get. But, you know, the way Ovi's playing, the way these guys are playing, I want to roll the dice with this team.
Rolling the dice is a good way to put it, too. I was thinking about it the other day. This is like a hashtag shower thought. But I was like, okay, what if you're like the best team in the league, so you win, you know, 2/3 of your games. You're just amazing. So you go into a 7-game series and you win 2/3 of your games. That means you take a normal dice die and you roll it. And as long as it doesn't come up 1 or 2, you win a game. So if you do that 7 times, like, what are the chances that it comes up 1 or 2, you know, 4 times out of 7, if that happens and you lose? And like, that was like the brief way of me thinking about like how, you know, random chancy the playoffs are. But to the thing that matters, I guess, for now, you're putting aside how variant things get in the postseason, is like how good can you get the team? And I have a hard time imagining like what improvements the team could make on the margins, especially when the margins are so damn good. So like, yeah, everything you said, I agree with. I'm a little bit warmer on Panic than you are, although I think it's really difficult. Like the clash between him and the team, the style is a little different there. He's not that offensively involved. And knowing what has happened in that same spot in the lineup in the past, where you had like Brett Connolly racking up goals with that elite sniper shooting, like that's a big difference there. But it's also like that third line's been doing pretty good lately, and the fourth line's the best in the league. And like, I guess when it comes down to it, like if I want anything to happen at the trade deadline, it wouldn't have anything to do with personnel. It'd just be what can the team do to improve tactics and strategy and you know, formulations for, might as well just get into it, the power play.
Well, before we get there, I even want to play devil's advocate. What about those people that say, well, Nick Jensen?
Okay, so Nick Jensen's it's a difficult topic, right? He is similar to Panic. He is a player whose style doesn't necessarily match the direction that the Cap style is going in, where the Capitals are a little bit more sort of like, I don't want to say free form, but they are very like aggressive and want to get lots of volume on offense. So their volume and quality on offense. And Jensen's a stay at home, shutdown defenseman who sometimes gets saddled with expectations of being something different than that he isn't. I think that he's fallen off since last season, to be frank. But I think that what we're seeing with him now is a combination of crummy luck, which is just happening when, like, you know, Braden Holtby behind him hasn't been great. And because his role is limited to defense, the only thing that we have the opportunity to notice of him or appreciate of him are his mistakes. When Jensen's doing his job well, you forget that he exists at all. Which is, you know, something like similar to what like Dmitry Orlov happens. And Dmitry Orlov has similar results to Nick Jensen, but he's having an amazing season on pretty much every other number. So I like Nick Jensen a lot. I wish whatever he's struggling with this season, I wish he could get under the control, because I think he could be an important component of the chess match that is a 7-game playoff series, possibly against a division team, where he gets, you know, if you have Nick Jensen going up against, I don't know, let's just say like Sebastian Aho or Andrei Svechnikov of the, you know, the Carolina Hurricanes, I'd be okay with that. I think that he'd be a good person to, you know, shut down that sort of free-flying attack from Carolina. I think I would be pretty comfortable with him going up against Sid or Gino if it's the Penguins. So I like Nick Jensen a lot, and I think he's the kind of component that you need for a playoff run, but I'm not super happy about his performance so far. That said, I wouldn't put him in the bottom two if I were to stack rank the defense. I think there you've got, well, Michael Kempney is probably the one that I worry about a little bit more than Nick Jensen.
Do you think that, like, it just seems like, you remember when Brooks Like hurt himself and then he came back and he wasn't Brooks Like? Do you think Kempney's a little off? Like, part of me thinks, like, personally, that maybe he just isn't back to his 100% self before the injury.
That hamstring injury was so nasty. You know, like, did he have compartment syndrome?
I don't think so, no.
But did he have surgery for the hamstring?
He did have surgery for the hamstring. I believe he completely tore it or partially tore it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a nasty injury. It could take a long time to come back. I mean, he doesn't seem as confident or as strong, maybe like sprightly, maybe is the way I put it, as he has in the past. The thing I was looking at it the other night in the article I put together about like visualizing defensemen and forwards together. And the thing that like it raised my attention was, I was expecting, like, if he was like noticeably slower, would he be committing more restraining penalties? And I don't see that's the case. And I'm wondering maybe if I'm trusting that metric the wrong way, because I still kind of suspect that he is having some health issues. And I don't know, maybe it's the kind of thing that gets better with time. Maybe he's a good person to, you know, rest here or there. With a person like that, if it's an injury that you can come back from, and I'm way more confident that, you know, Michael Kempney could come back from a hamstring injury than Brooks Like could from his groin injury.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was it a groin injury?
It was the thing in the abdominal groin area.
Okay. It was the triangular dick muscle. Anyway, we should not talk about Brooks Like on this podcast. Anyway,
I went so long without cursing, and then you killed it with the D.
That's not a curse.
What, D isn't?
No, it's not. Do you want to talk about the power play now?
Yeah, let's do power play. Sorry.
It sucks. Yeah, I guess is the short way to put it.
So, God, like, I can't stand the shorthanded goals. Like, it makes me want to like super kick my computer and then go complete Office Space style on it.
There's so like the traditional measurement for a power play is like power play efficiency, which is like, okay, if I get 10 power play opportunities and I score 3 power play goals on those opportunities, then I've got a 30% power play. That is dumb. That's not the right way to do it, because that doesn't count what happens on the other end of the ice, right? Your efficiency is always going to be lower than what your power play efficiency says, because you're going to lose the goal that you gain from the shorties you give up. And knowing that the Capitals have given up, what is it, 9 now? And a lot of them have happened since Thanksgiving, since like the midway part of the season. Their power play is genuinely like bottom 5, bottom 6 in the league right now, from a team that I don't think has hopped noticeably out of the top 10 for what, 6 years. So yeah. Like there's a lot that you could argue that's happening here. Like the first thing is like maybe like the most obvious one, which doesn't necessarily mean I give a lot of credence, but the most obvious one is everyone's running a version of this power play, the like strong side D shot diamond formation 1-3-1 power play. You see it especially in like San Jose. Actually, I haven't seen it recently if they're running in San Jose, but like I would say more than half the teams of the league, maybe 2/3 of the team, run some version of this because of how effective it was. Thanks, Adam Oates, for the one thing that you did for the team. Or really, the power play coach Blaine Forsythe did for the team at the time. So that is so prevalent that it's unavoidable that teams would be revising their like counterplay strategies for it. So it's definitely something that's getting scouted for, and teams have okay, here's what we do in these cases here. I don't necessarily think that it goes a long way towards explaining it, because if that were the case, you'd see power play efficiency flowing up all across the league, and that's not happening. Which leaves I think the more likely case, which is that the Capitals are having trouble with some really basic stuff. Which comes like fundamentals, like the breakout zone entry and the puck movement that precedes what is the centerpiece of the power play, the Ovi shot from the Ovi spot.
I thought you were going to say the slingshot.
No. I don't necessarily agree with this. I mean, there are like there is the pass from the half wall, which is often Nick Backstrom, but lately it had been like Kuznetsov a little bit back to Carlson. This is after they've already been in formation, so it's not necessarily when they're like explicitly forechecking. And that pass gets intercepted a lot lately, which means that folks are basically like the defenders are effectively like floating higher in the zone, closer to Carlson to cut off that shot, or in other cases. Especially with Kuznetsov just didn't have the subtlety that Backstrom has with it and was telegraphing it a bunch. And that pass got that turnover a bit, or they're able to pressure Carlson way more than Carlson's used to. So you see all of a sudden the puck just heading the other way. And I guess another unavoidable thing is that the goalies have not stopped those breakaway chances. So of those nine, and this is one that I wouldn't have believed until I looked it up, Samsonov is responsible for five of the nine shorties and Holtby for four. Yeah. So it's actually Sammy's probably the bigger problem there than Holtby, especially because Sammy's had way less power play time. So
though, like, to be fair, if you're giving up breakaways constantly on the power play, the fault is usually with someone dinking around in the ozone.
For sure. Yeah. So I how do you fix that? I don't know. What I don't want to see them do is totally blow it up. Meaning I don't want to see them put Ovechkin in the Carlson spot. That's what they did in 2011, 2012, and 2013 when Ovechkin's goal count started going down. And then Hunter took him off the power play entirely for sometimes. That seems like that's counterproductive, right? You need to activate Alex Ovechkin. He's extremely special. Don't outthink yourself here. What do you think?
I think you hit the nail on the head is that it's simple stuff. It's simple stuff and carry-ins. I think the team is the team has certain ways of getting in the zone that they get comfortable with over, months, years. And when teams start knowing that's coming and start pressuring it, then you start seeing some lazy passes, some dumb passes, some turnovers. And then they're uncomfortable. I've seen a lot of uncomfortableness from the power play. And I think the thing is that why the 1-3-1 works is that if there's only four guys on the ice, and I know that sounds really stupid, but whatever those four guys do, they're always giving you something. No matter what strategy you line up with, you're always going to have something. And what I think the problem is that if they're not getting into the zone well and they're not setting up correctly, you kind of hurry through that or make a dumb play. And I just really think that someone like TJ Oshie or whoever's in that middle, Tom Wilson or Jacob Verana or Nicholas Backstrom, one of those three guys, they need to start feeding them. They need to focus on them. And what happens is that if TJ Oshie scores three power play goals in a row, what's going to happen? They're going to sag off Ovechkin just a little bit. And I think really it's, hockey's a game of inches. And when, Ovi's scoring like 650 of your 652 goals, everyone's going to kind of focus in on him more. And if you still keep feeding Ovechkin, it's just not going to work. And so I think you're right, is that I don't think they need to overthink anything. I think they need to go back to what they were doing before and just focus on trying to get someone else to score. And yeah. I think that will just open everything up.
If they just get into that diamond, we've seen over and over again that other teams will just shoot themselves in the foot, just leaving Alex Ovechkin all alone. As long as you get the puck moving well, which you absolutely do especially with Nick Backstrom on the half wall, which is such a good spot for him. It's a great combination of skill set and position. So I'm not that worried about it. But if we're still talking like this in March, I probably will be a little worried about it. Like, it's time for this to get better.
I'm kind of worried about some of the solutions, to be honest. I think some of the
things haven't liked what they've done so far. No.
Yeah. What they've done over the last 2 weeks with Dower Blaine, my boy Dower Blaine, who's always excited. If it reeks of throwing bologna against the wall and just seeing what sticks. And didn't they move Ovi to the opposite side or put him at the D man position?
For a little bit. They've been having Ovi switch with Carlson as not as like a default, but as like calling an option basically.
Yeah.
And then that they tried for one period of one game last week was basically just mirroring it and having Ovi on the opposite side, which is such a weird galaxy brain move that I don't think it helps anybody.
When I saw that, I got concerned because I was like, if anything, leave Ovi there. Again, it's not about trying to get Ovi to score. It's about trying to get all five people opportunities to score. And if Ovi has, you know, most of the power play goals, or, you know, one thing, this is actually a good point too, that I didn't really think about until I did the article about Jacob Arana replacing Evgeny Kuznetsov on the power play. Kuzi has a ton of power play goals this year.
Does he?
That might be an underrated part of the struggles continuing too, is that maybe Kuzi should stay there. Like, I'm not saying that necessarily Kuzi's the best guy to be on a power play one, the way his galaxy brain is thinking sometimes, where he forces passes or the shots that he do take are just not very good shots. But, you know, when they were really clicking a year or two ago, I mean, he was just threading the needle to guys. And it just, again, when you get Oshie, when you get the other guys opened up, I think that's the key. And I think it's really small. Like you said, is that it's just dumb stuff. It's in their heads. They're trying too hard. Just go back to what you did. Feed Oshie one time or two times or three times. Once he gets on the board, Ovi will open up. And then, you know, they're going to have a 50% rate for like 10 games. And then we'll forget about this.
I was when I like share like an article about the shorties and stuff, I don't consider myself like an X's and O's guy necessarily. I just read a couple books about it. Like, I obviously didn't play. I don't coach. But we had some, you know, folks in like comments saying like, oh, they should do what I don't remember who, it may have been like Ryan Stimson, said like is like a cool alternate formulation, which is basically where you have like two guys below the goal line, which seems maddening. But I know like you lose the opportunity that you have with the diamond, like you get fewer opportunity costs, but the chances you get will be higher quality because you have the goalie basically turning their head from side to side and trying to control, like lock down the post and the high like slot passes, which is a really interesting thing. I don't even see that for it. Like I've got ex Penguins coach, the worst Penguins coach of the last 10 years, Mike Johnston's book, Hockey Place and Strategies, and that's not even in there. Like, you know, the wild move there. I would like to see them try. It honestly, it all just comes down to they need Marcus Johansson. That's what it is. You really need somebody to get you in the zone, and then just maximize like zone time. That's it. All right, let's get off the power play. Power play is like the worst part about the team, and we spent 15 minutes talking about it. Let's talk about Alex Ovechkin, who has been okay lately. I haven't been disappointed with his effort at all in his 11 goals in the last five games.
Yeah, I don't. You know, we should be able to like put this into proper perspective, but like
I can't.
It is bonkers. Like, weren't you doing like a rolling five game averages thing of his goal scoring, and this was the best streak he's ever had?
Yeah, he had never hit 10 over five games, and he's been at 11 for three. So So like it's and he's 34 years old. So he's a solid 9 years past what should be a hockey player's goal streak, like hottest like scoring point.
What do you think is behind that?
I mean, it's a bunch of stuff, and like, you know, we've hit all like the basic elements. The one that I think is most underrated. No, it's not underrated because it's the damn name of our website. But his durability is unprecedented. Like you had an article about it. I had one about it earlier this year as well. Like he just doesn't miss games. He plays big minutes in every game. An injury that seems like it would take somebody out for weeks, he plays the next shift. He's inhuman. So like the fact that he plays big minutes, his shot rate goes up. I honestly think that when people bought into the Ovi like aging curve down decline, which a lot of analysts did, they said, oh, eventually he'll have a hard time scoring 30 or 20 goals. And he did have one season where he scored 34 or whatever it was. That was probably thinking that the attributing to the aging curve something which was really a team downturn, because it seems like Alex Ovechkin's shot rate as a percentage of his like offensive zone time, which you can measure by like the team's shooting percentage, like shooting shot rate when he's on the ice, is relatively static, but he's had less opportunity to do what he does when the team wasn't as good at 5-on-5. And now that he's getting lots and lots of zone time, because I mean, I'll start with this, the defensive core is as good as it's been since ever. I think this is probably the best six-man defensive core that the Caps have ever had. Only because, like, even when they were really, really good in 2017, they had one big weakness in Carl Alsner and then another somewhat weakness in Brooks Orpik, which was mitigated by Nate Schmidt being amazing next to him. So you don't have an obvious black hole like that with this team right now. And so every time Alex Vetchkin's on the ice, he's destroying it. Something about John Carlson, like, if you could say that John Carlson's like a one-dimensional player, he gets points off of Alex Ovechkin, I can see where you're coming from. But the fact of the matter is that the team is getting tons and tons of offense. So right now, Carlson and Ovechkin, when they're on the ice together, get 53% of the expected goals. That same number a couple seasons ago, when the team was damn good, was 47%.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, like, the team had to get really lucky or have to use that like elite finishing skill when Carlson and Ovechkin were on the ice to be successful in 2017. Now they got that same talent, but they've got way more opportunity. They're getting burned on defense way less.
I want to speak to that a little bit. I think part of that, I think part of the magic of Ovi, at least, he's gotten better at 5-on-5, which is crazy at that age. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it too is that the way the Capitals transition, where Carlson has used the stretch pass unbelievably. If you know, I'm not necessarily a huge John Carlson fan, but the thing that I really geek out about him is not the pass to Ovi in the zone, not his 100 miles per hour slap shot. It's his stretch passes. It's like watching Stockton to Malone when he sends these long passes from the D zone up to Ovi. And then Ovi has this just unbelievable ability with a slap shot or his wrister to just get off unbelievably hard shots on that wing, on either wing. And I think that's just part of it, is that Ovi has such a good shot, like Brett Hall, that, you know, he just can create things out of nothing. And so even if he doesn't have that same skating ability, he's still just unbelievably effective because his shot is so good. I would have thought, okay, Peter, that, you know, we watched his shooting, the amount of shot attempts that he had go down over time. Yeah. So we are seeing an aging curve, I think, with him. I think when people say, you know, he's defying age, I actually disagree. Like, I don't think he's beating Father Time necessarily in a way. Like, what I think he's doing is he constantly reinvents himself and becomes more optimal. And that sounds like a really, you know, cheap way, but like, I think he just is able to find the back of the net in more creative, easier ways. And his shot hasn't dropped off. He's not shooting as much, but, you know, his shot quality has maybe even gone up as he's gotten older. And I think that's,
I bet you're right about the quality part, but about like his raw shot rate, like he was, where he's at now is not significantly far off where he was in like 2009, 2010. Like, he's still shooting at that same rate, like raw numbers. And I don't know if his like expected goals. Yeah. And so, excuse me, I just burped on the microphone there, but, his expected goals right now are about one per hour, which is you know, about as high as it's, I don't know, it's about as high as it's ever been, aside from like 2008, 2009, where he was, you know, scoring 65 goals. So like, what he's effectively done is flatlined when you expected him to go off a cliff. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The fact that he's maintained this much offense is, oh, really special. It's amazing that you were able to speak so praisefully about John Carlson, because like, we have a bias at Russia Machine Never Breaks that we're interested in interesting players, and he doesn't have the personality of anyone. Like, he's just a, you know, a dad.
I think we should call him the bro John Carlson.
Even his broness is subdued by his dadness. Jersey dad. He was certainly a bro in like 2010, and now he's just dad.
The bro dad.
Yeah.
The really quiet bro dad. Yeah, I know. I agree with you. And
poor John, really good hockey player. He's just not interesting. Like, he plays with Kuznetsov and Wilson and Ovechkin. What are you going to do? You know?
Yeah. I would never buy that guy's shirt, but I really admire.
Do you remember earlier in the episode when you said I'm like Nick Backstrom? That was the biggest insult you've ever.
No. You know why? Can I tell you why?
Hit me.
Is that people don't know that you're the MVP. It's actually very sweet. It's that, okay, it's whatever. That, it's that you're very intense and you're very creative. And I think those, that's how I describe Nicholas Backstrom. Like when I met him, and I've talked to him in the past, that intense, that quiet intensity is just very noticeable. And, he's just very thoughtful. He's very, very thoughtful. And I think you have the same thing going on. It's just, you know, you're thinking about things like you're in a different dimension than I'm in. You know what I mean? That's what I admire about you.
All right,
that's what
all
I wish right. I had.
Can we close out this episode of the podcast with a short and restrained conversation about the goalies?
Yes.
So Braden Holtby, not having a great season. Things are looking pretty rough heading into what should be you know, a payday of $60 to $80 million on his next contract. That plus Bobrovsky, who's gotten better in the last couple of weeks. So Bob's maybe turning it around. But I am very worried about my boy Braden Holtby. He's had two of his last three games have been damn good. You were like right around like 93% saving. But you can't deny that Ilya Samsonov is the goalie who has done the best so far this season. And while like we can maybe be skeptical and open-minded about what will happen in the next, you know, 200, 400 shots that these goalies face, and I have a suspicion that maybe Holtby would outperform Samsonov in those. And it's very unlikely that Samsonov's true talent level is where his current saving position is. You got to like what you're seeing out of him. If you are Todd Reirden, and not just his party buddy, what would you do with the remaining, I don't know, was it like 28 games or whatever?
Yeah, that's a tough one. There's two ways of thinking. There really is two ways of thinking. Is you take the safe route. You kind of just go where things go. Meaning, if Samsonov gives up three or four goals to the Penguins, you go back to Holtby. And you kind of just go back and forth and ride it out. I remember there was a time with, I think it was Michael Neuvirth and Varlamov, and I think Neuvirth and Holtby. And both of them were like 1A, 1B. And you just kind of went with the guy that was playing well, and when that guy drops off, you give the other guy a shot. And I think there is a self-fulfilling motivation with that. And I actually think that's the easy way to go in this situation, is just ride the guy that's playing good, you know. And if you suck one game, you sit and, you know, and you just go with it. There could be another way of thinking, which maybe you'd want to consider, is that Samsonov has won the job. And he's also the goalie of the future.
That's and, nuts. That's absolutely nuts. And, to say that he's won the job.
Hear me out. Hear me out. That he's won the job. That he's the goalie of the future. That... you know you're going with him next year because you know you can't bring Holtby back. Wouldn't it make sense to start slowly transitioning him into the starter's role down the stretch and going with him in the playoffs so that regardless of what happens, you get that year of experience under him and he's getting even better? You know what I mean? I don't think this team's going to fall off from this year to next year. Like, I don't know how that would happen. So, you know, ride that hot hand rookie. Those are the two scenarios I see. I think the first one would probably be the best for what's going on. And I still believe in Braden Holtby. He was amazing the other day. But I'm always a guy that kind of thinks more in the future than more in right now. And so I could, you know, I'd really want to see what you have in Samsonov. Like, I feel like the more you see of what you have with Samsonov, the better off you are at the end of the year, regardless of what happens.
There's like an operating assumption that you and I are both using that we're letting go unsaid, which is that we are both working with as a fact that the Caps will not re-sign Braden Holtby in the summer, which is the right thing to do. But I'm just making it explicit because the team just couldn't afford him. It wouldn't be a good move if they could. There's going to be a team that's going to pay him well, and we'll be very happy for him and Brandy to get that big, big bucks.
Let me stop you there too. Like with Holtby's season so far, has he dropped off where he's back in the Capitals, like where they could bring him back? I think that's a worthy question with the way he's played this year.
No way. No.
Is he more of a $7.5-$8 million guy now? And with that extra $2 or $3 million, you can bring him back. I actually think that's becoming something that you could speak about.
No, honestly. I don't think so. So he's making 6 now. He's gonna make more. It'll be under 10. I think it'll be over 7, and I think the Caps can't afford more than 2. Like the Caps the Caps have to take a haircut here because they've got a lot to do next summer. I mean, you lose
Gudas. Where did Backstrom go? Backstrom went to 9.2, so he went up 3. So yeah. Backstrom is the Gudas money that goes off the board. So if Holtby stays around 6, 7, 8, and they trade one guy, it could work. It could.
Yeah, but they don't want to trade anybody.
But then the problem becomes Ovechkin the next year. Like,
yes,
I don't know.
Exactly.
Like,
that's the big thing. Like, you have to carve out at least 8, I would say, for Ovi. At least for a couple years.
I would be crazy. I think you have to carve out at least 13, 12, 13.
That would be crazy.
More than that. I think he's going to take a little less. That much.
Tell you how he's not worth that much?
Yeah, like because of how many goals he scores, and he's an MVP. He's still an MVP player. You have to
Pay him, but he'll be 2 years player. Older then.
That's true. But he might be still doing now, the same thing.
And just like judging by like the sound my knees make when I go downstairs, I'm assuming that Ovi's going to be less.
I have that too. how does he score so many goals? I could. Some days I walk outside. And I'm like, I can't do it.
By the way, me and Ian are both old. The thing is, you just don't want to vaporize that much money for a goalie who's after the age of 30. No matter what, it's just a bad idea. And it's also like a really exciting thing. I really want Braden to get paid big bucks and go to like Vancouver or God help us Edmonton or something. Like I would be happy to see him go out west and make some good money, and maybe he gets bought out after 4 years and just plays crappy acoustic guitar and brings his capo to parties so he can play Wonderwall in the appropriate frat. Like, with 28 games left, I hope that they get it as close to like 14-14 as possible. I'm opposed to the idea of riding the hot hand just for burnout. It looks like there's only about 4 games without any rest. So there's only 4 back-to-backs where you know they're going to swap from one goalie to the other unless something awful happens. God forbid, knock on wood. But I would say you give both these guys as many reps as you can without favoring one or burning out one, and then make the call as late as possible. I'm talking like it's April before you decide who your starting goalie is in the playoffs. And heck, we've seen Braden be cool with it if it's not him before. And I'd be happy. I mean, it would be an anguishing way to do it. But if it ends up being, you know, Holtby doesn't start the playoffs and he comes in if he has to.
Watch out, that team.
I adore that human being. I adore him as a player. God help you if you're coming in against, relief Braden Holtby. Coming to save the team.
Yeah, an angry Braden Holtby that's looking for respect and just a contract.
Smoldering. half the audience, the basement's flooded. Like it's gonna be a dangerous situation there.
But a great way to cap this off is how awesome is it that they have just developed Samsonov like a gem. I mean, he was already really good, but the things that they've done where this year before training camp, he's living with the goalie coach. And Alexiev's there too. The way they developed him in Hershey, I mean, I was down there. They have a guy that is like with these top end prospects, making sure that they're developing. I mean, the Capitals are, I don't know if we say this enough. The organization from where we saw them 10, 15 years ago to where they are now with the analytics program, with the decision making they do with lines. I don't feel like I've written one negative story about the lines this year.
Target, but you're right. You're absolutely right. And another Samsonov has probably the best hype man in the NHL right now.
Yeah.
Like he's got the Jimmy Hart. He's got the Bobby Heenan. He's got the... What's Heyman's last name? Paul. He got the Paul Heyman. He's got Paul Bearer.
No. Paul Bearer is kind of weird.
Thank you. That's my only wrestling impersonation I do.
Can I tell you something funny? This actually goes to this, and we can end on this. So when I was at Topgolf, and I need to write this story about all the things Ovi told me. even though there's nothing really juicy in there. It's just funny golf stuff. But as I was leaving, I was going to just ask one question on video to Orlov, Kuznetsov, and Samsonov about how they did at golf, because Russians don't really – well, actually, I shouldn't generalize. These Russians don't really play golf much. And so I was just going to ask them how it went, and I was like, oh, I'm going to get comedy. And so Orlov's walking out with Samsonov like he's his, like, protector. It's like Ilya is the cub, and Dmitry Orlov, who is a teddy bear, is like his bear father. And I was like, hey, can I ask you guys something really quick about the golf? And Orlov, who is literally the nicest person on earth, like he is Carl Alsner, like, level. He goes, there was a night before a game and Samsonov was definitely starting. He's like, we need to go right now. I am very, very sorry, but Ilya has start tomorrow, must concentrate. And it was like 7 o'clock. You know what I mean? But it's just like... The Russians on this team are incredible. Like, you know, and I think we've had a really, like, you know, at least me through, like, Igor, like, I think we didn't, like, everyone as Caps fans didn't really appreciate Alex Semin nearly enough for how good he was, because of a lot of stupid narrative stuff that I think is gone now from, is mostly getting away from hockey now, which, thank God. But like, you know, this kid, I mean, they are really developing him well, and it's a great story. So
I'm excited to see him as the number one boy. I just hope it's not until October.
That's fair. I'm you know what? I love Braden. Like, can we just end it on that? He has been a transformative guy in this franchise.
Yeah.
Just with, you know, marching in the DC Pride parades and stuff like that, and and just being an unbelievably good goalie, and what, being a fifth round pick, and having such a great beard and being
great beard.
Remember the Holpeisms? Remember the Holpeisms?
Those that was early days.
Yeah.
So, all right. I'm going to get this thing sliced up for the people's drive time commute coming home on Friday afternoon. So, Ian, thank you so much. Go Caps. We got some hockey on Saturday night and a lot to do down the stretch.
Bye, everybody. Enjoy.
Bye.
This has been Russian Machine Never Breaks, the podcast. But now, it's over. Nothing to see here. Move along.